Hello, everyone. I'm Manon Herzog from Polyplexus and will host today's episode of Talk Polymath. In this episode, we are speaking with Dr. Stacy Woods, the Senior Data Scientist in the Science Office of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her work focuses on spatial statistics and data visualization to inform NRDC's environmental and litigation work. For those of you joining us for the first time, Polyplexus is a DARPA-funded platform dedicated to removing barriers and accelerating the research process. You can join our community at polyplexus.com. Stacy, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So, Stacy, given your work is so multifaceted and far-reaching, let's maybe start with a concrete example. Can you tell us more about the Flint water case in Michigan and the science office's role in it?
Yes. So the Flint water case actually predates my time at NRDC. When I joined NRDC, when I joined the science office, I was approached by the litigators at NRDC. We have an incredible litigation team, and they had heard through the grapevine that I occasionally make maps. And so they were wondering, they had just received a bunch of maps as part of their litigation, and they were wondering if I could just take a look at them. And I said, sure. And I looked at the maps and I thought, I can't really explain these maps to you because these are not good maps. And I started talking about what kind of information we really need to see from the city of Flint in order to, you know, assess the question that was being asked, which was at the time, was the city of Flint living up to the promises that it made to address the lead water crisis? And when they were submitting these maps, we looked at it and we decided that we couldn't actually tell what they were doing based on these maps. So we started asking for more data. And when we received the information from the city and did our own analysis, we realized that the city at the time was not actually targeting the areas at highest risk for lead service lines. And that had actually been part of the settlement agreement. They had agreed to actually go to the areas at highest risk. And so when we found out that they weren't doing a good job, we started to bring an argument for the application of data science to help the city of Flint really move fast at the city at the areas of highest risk. And so that's where my work in Flint started.
Got you. And as I understand it, and you just mentioned maps, so I'll continue down that path, your work didn't end with the water case itself and developing better maps. You then turned the data collected into interactive maps so residents could track progress made and also access critical information to protect their health. And I was wondering, as I was reading about that, given the data already exists, is empowering citizens on an ongoing basis a best practice you would like to institute with all your projects?
Certainly. And in fact, the Flint map started with a simple request from our community partners, which was, well, can I see the data? And of course, the answer is yes. This is your home. This is your data. You should have access to it. The problem was that the data at the time was in, you know, predictive analytic form. It was a probability number. It wasn't really user-friendly. It wasn't ready to be released without some work. And so we worked with our community partners to figure out how to best actually share that information in a way that is accessible and actionable by the people of Flint. And so that is where it was the community members ask that led to the Flint pipe map. And the Flint pipe map is available. It's on the web at flintpipemap.org. And you can see the map that we built with our community members that shared the probability and then of every individual home whether or not they had a high likelihood of lead. And also for homes where the city had actually gone to inspect and sometimes replace lead service lines, we had that actual data. So what was found at each home. And so the map, the Flint map, is a direct result of communities asking for their own data, which they should have access to. And that certainly informed the way that I continue to do my work.
So, Stacey, I will briefly quote you. In 2020, you said, "Our work in Flint demonstrates that we can use the data we have to find the 6 to 10 million lead pipes still lurking under homes across America." And with that, it sounds like Flint was just the beginning, right? You are now trying to take this same effort national. And I must admit, I had no idea how pervasive the issue was, though it certainly makes sense given infrastructure in many cities is old.
Yes. So I think that you are definitely not alone. I think a lot of people were shocked to find out that lead exists in water service lines in so many of our homes, in cities across the country. There's been a real call for action from citizens and communities across the country, not just in Flint. Flint raised awareness, but the action is being taken everywhere. One of the things that I was really heartened about this past year was the revisions to the lead and copper rule, which will mandate that water utilities provide public access to their lead service line inventory. This is great. Right now, nobody has a requirement to let people know where lead is in their community. The problem is, in a lot of communities, we don't know where the lead is. So if you require a water utility to release its known lead inventory, that water utility is only going to be able to tell you of the homes that it has gone and inspected and seen whether there's a lead or not a lead water service line. My point in that quote that you read is that there's actually more information beyond just city records that we can use to figure out where lead might be in cities. So for example, older homes have much higher probability of having lead service lines, and homes that are clustered together in old neighborhoods also have higher probabilities. So using these kind of variables that can help us predict, we need to be able to use this and not just say, well, the data's not there, we can't do anything about it. We have more data than we think, and we can use that, and we can use predictive analytics to get at where people might be exposed right now and help those people figure out how to reduce their exposure.
And in trying to figure out these variables and coming up with patterns potentially, are you looking to partners like Google.org or others? Because it sounds like there are probably many out there who have other data sets or other capabilities that could actually enhance what you are trying to do.
Certainly. So we are always open and actively seeking partners. We actually have been partnering with Google.org and also with We Act for Environmental Justice, which is an amazing group, as well as a tech company called Blue Conduit, who helped us tremendously in Flint and in other cities. So with the support from Google.org, that group is now expanding the work that we did in Flint to other cities, including Buffalo, New York, Richmond, Virginia, and New Orleans as well.
That's terrific. And while you already have a great group of partners, is there possibly a dream partner out there that you haven't been able to bring into the fold yet?
I find that the community expertise is the most critical piece in any of these environmental health projects. So we are always looking for our community partners that we can join with and join our expertise together to address issues like lead service lines.
That actually brings up an interesting question. does it make sense to go beyond community organizations and directly to citizens? Do they potentially hold information that could be helpful?
Surely. I mean, there are citizens who know what their pipes are made of when communities don't. And part of the Flint map and our future maps always entails a contact us link, as well as in the FAQs, it says, is your information wrong? Contact us. And that's not just about updating the information for one house on the map. We actually update the model. So when a citizen calls in and says, I live here and my water pipe is actually made of this, not only do we fix the information on our end on the website, we update the city with that information, but we also update our predictive models. So when we get better information, which we can only get, again, from that lived expertise, the people in the homes, then it makes the predictions better. It allows us to inform the cities about where they're going to want to go to address the lead service lines faster, and everybody benefits.
Yeah, so I was fascinated to learn about the many ways in which you collect data. Sticking with Flint for a moment, it sounds like you were sifting through more than 40,000 handwritten index cards. You employed, of course, geographic information systems and even artificial intelligence. And I might be wrong, but it sounds like each project poses new challenges and requires to some degree a bespoke approach. Can you take us through what the outset of a project looks like? From afar, it sounds like it's a little bit like detective work.
It is a detective work. And I want to, again, just say, give gratitude to our partners. I personally didn't sift through for, you know, thousands and thousands of index cards. Our partners did. And so again, going back to this idea that it really is a full community work that gets us to where we need to go. In terms of the data, it is shocking how varied public utility data can be. In some cities, you have very clean, incredibly well-kept, meticulous records. And in those cities, the record of service line material, so what your pipe is made of, as far as the city knows, might tend to be correct. In other cities, sometimes older cities, you know, maybe they have really old housing stock. Maybe the majority of the housing stock predates computers. So you're talking about records that have been handwritten and maybe erased and written over, maybe smudged, maybe somebody spilled their coffee on it. So you can't just assume that you start with the records and the record is the fact. I think that was one of the most eye-opening pieces for me in Flint was that first step, okay, we have the records. Now let's see how correct they are. And then from there, we move forward and update where we don't have records.
And so what were some of the steps you took? You started out with those cards. And then how did you decide to fill in the gaps? Can you take us a little bit more through that process?
Sure. So the very first step was digitizing the cards. And then we had people who were doing manual updates. So even if you scan a card, if this card, like I said, happens to be an old handwritten, smudged and coffee card, you need a human to look at that digital record and try to figure out, is that an A? Is it an 8? Is it a B? Is it somebody's, you know, doodle in the margin. So there was a real human element there. And that was done by people at the University of Michigan with the help of a company called Captricity. And so they did as much as they could to get the old records digital so that we could then scrape from the digital records and start to build databases where we had addresses and what we called city record. We didn't call them known out, you know, we didn't anticipate that what the city record said was the pipe material was necessarily the right pipe material, However, we wanted a record of what the city had on file. And we did this for as many homes as we could. And then we started comparing on the ground data with what our record said. So as Flint was moving forward through their pipe replacement program, we were getting updated information from the engineers on the ground who were showing up in people's houses, going into the basement and looking at the pipes, or sometimes they were digging in the ground, you know, in the front yard until they found that pipe. And then they were updating the data sets. And so that allowed us to then start checking against what we, our best guess at what that city record said. And then we could build models. How right do we anticipate the city record to be for houses overall? But then how correct do we anticipate the city records to be for houses that meet certain criteria, for houses that were built before 1920, for houses that are in close proximity to other homes that are known to be lead? So we started kind of creating this inferential model, and that helped us figure out how reliable those records might be. And again, I want to pause for a moment and just thank the folks who were doing all this work, particularly the modelers at University of Michigan and also at Blue Conduit. They just did incredible work here.
So am I correct in saying that as you built this model and as you learn more and more, that it almost becomes an intelligent model, right? Where you with ever greater input, probably have ever greater probability of getting the right result, understanding, yes, if it is a house that was built before 1920, X, Y, and Z applies in all likelihood. And is that then something you can extrapolate and make some of those assumptions across the country, or does it really change community by community?
So that is actually what we're exploring right now, again, with Blue Conduit on the kind of modeling lead, NRDC, We Act for Environmental Justice, and Google. That is precisely the question we're asking. So we've done the work we've done in Flint. We work together there. Blue Conduit has done additional work in other cities. And so we're starting to build this knowledge base. You know, what might apply most broadly and what is really specific to particular communities? And so you can kind of see how this knowledge becomes iterative. And as we learn more, we learn more. And so our ability to do the work improves with every piece of the puzzle that we get. And so, yeah, we're in the process of doing that work right now.
Great. And all of that is incredibly positive and incredibly important work. But I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the ethical implications of big data. And are there any examples where the use of big data has gone wrong in your field?
Sure. So I really sit very strongly in the water quality area. So I'm going to speak to that. And I mean, certainly there are examples outside of my field. But when I talk to our community partners, when I talk to people whose data I have been entrusted with, some of the concerns that I hear are, you know, about privacy and how do we address that concern? You know, we can't ask every single person, what do you want shown on the map? So how do we capture the concerns of the entire community in which we're working? Again, community partners are the leaders here. We are just the support team. And so we really look to our individual community partners and individual citizens to lead the way on the ethical concerns of their data for their homes and their communities. In Flint, through a series of, you know, community involvement groups, input, the community was asking for the home-specific outcomes. Now, Flint is maybe a unique case because there was an option there through the Flint pipe replacement program to get lead pipes replaced at no cost to homeowners. Mm-hmm. But what happens when you're in a community where there isn't that option? So you have to consider, you know, a community member who owns a home, and then you make a map showing that home in red, indicating that home has a lead service line. What, like, and you've never met this person, and you don't, you know, you don't have any relationship with that person. What might that person feel about that information on their home being on the map? So these are considerations that are different in Flint and from other places, because you can imagine a homeowner who wants to make their home not red for any number of reasons, for their own health, but also for, I don't say resale value, right? Mm-hmm. They are now going to have to pay to fix that data. And so that is a real ethical concern that we have that is unique when we are working outside of the community where there is that no cost solution, and also where we have such a connection with so many people.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up an interesting question, right? Yes, when there is the option of getting your pipes fixed for free, that's one scenario. But if you're already in a less desirable neighborhood, say, or if you're already in a neighborhood that is predominantly minority population, and there is no assistance, are you actually setting those communities back, even though you're trying to help them?
And I think that this is a tension that exists, but particularly exists when you don't have collaborators, when you aren't supporting a community movement. Yeah. And so I really try and focus my work where I can support a community ask, as opposed to coming in from the outside and bringing that work.
Yeah.
Again, lead. There's lead. There's so much lead. So there are endless opportunities to work and support community members who are concerned, who want to see that information, who want to know it. And so that's really where we can start the work.
Right, right. So greatly appreciate that you are focused very much on anything related to water health. But I will ask a broader question for a moment. On a scale of 1 to 10, how optimistic are you about our environment's future?
Well, as a scientist, I am heartened by the ongoing just explosion of not just abilities, right? The more we learn, the more we make, the more we recognize, but of passions. The younger scientific generation and the community, the younger community members have a real passion about the environment. They see the impacts of climate change. They're living the impacts of climate change. It's no longer in the realm of specialists. This is a conversation that everyone is having. And this is where, again, because my work seats me in communities, this is where I operate most often. And therefore, it is easy to be on the optimistic side of that scale. Mm-hmm. Shading above the fives. It is frustrating when you leave that expanding bubble, but still a bubble, and see that there are choices being made by people who have so much power. And those choices are not in the interests of the environment. They are not in the interests of their of those people's own children or grandchildren. I don't understand that. And so in not understanding, I think I can shade more towards pessimism if I pay attention, I think, to that side. However, again, I just want to give credit to the people that I get to work with, because it keeps us in the positive side of the 1 to 10 scale.
So many scientists in recent months have taken sometimes truly drastic measures to sound the alarm about climate change. Do you think doomsday narratives are effective in encouraging us to take action?
So as someone who's rooted in statistics, I have to say I have not crunched any data on messaging outcomes. I just don't know. That is not my area of expertise. And I understand why people want to be straightforward, because the outcomes that we're discussing, even though it is a range, that range itself can be quite dire, is dire. Already, what we're living in is dire. It's already an emergency. So I understand that messaging. I also am hearing the pushback against that negative messaging, right? But I just don't know, as somebody who hasn't looked at the outcomes, I'm not sure which is the right answer.
All right, I'll flip the question a little bit and bring it closer to data. In your mind, can data play a role in telling positive yet informed stories to affect change?
Well, definitely. In my experience, it has. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the Flint map, you will see a sea of green. That's good news green. That mm-hmm. is the story of that map going from red and orange, danger, to green. Like, we're pretty sure that all of these greenhouses can, you know, they do not have lead pipes any longer. I mean, that is the good news data story. Data helped inform the Flint pipe replacement program, and that changed the environment in that city, and it can do it elsewhere.
Yeah. And so with that, where are you going next? We've already talked a little bit about taking essentially what you did in Flint National. I know you also worked on a manatee project in Florida. Can you just give us a little bit of a sense what's next for you?
Well, I'm really excited to continue my lead work again. And unfortunately, lead is a continuing problem. It doesn't just hit one community, but like you pointed to earlier, there are communities who have less resources to address the problem. And so I'm really excited to continue that work, particularly through the Google.org funded collaboration with We Act and Blue Conduit. So I'm really looking forward to expanding our work there. And I will also be continuing to look towards water quality and health areas that I can contribute, because I think it's really important that data scientists contribute to the environmental fight.
Well, Stacey, we will be watching you turning maps from red to green. Thanks again for joining us today. And for listeners who want to follow up with you, what is the easiest way to get in touch with you?
If you're just going to Google, Stacey Woods NRDC should find my expert page, and that has my contact information, some background, as well as some of the projects that I'm working on.
Thanks again, Stacey. We really appreciate it. And to check out more cross-disciplinary conversations, follow us on the Polyplexus YouTube channel.
Thank you.